All right, here we go on a Monday. It's Cody and Gold, Alex Gold, Cody Tapp, Drew Nixon with you. We'll get to Friday night's festivities out at Hollywood Casino. A lot of you that made it out there had a great time. We sure did. It was good to see you guys. It was good to hang out with you a little bit and also hear from Michael Massey and Kyle Isbell. So we'll get to that maybe during this hour. Also, a reminder, Royals have a day game today in Milwaukee to try to get their second win of the season. That will take place a little after 1 o'clock. It means Vern's On Deck show is at noon today. So we're on for 2 hours, and we hope you guys, of course, will stick with us during the show. And of course, during Vern's pregame on the Odyssey app as well. Make sure you check it out. I'm in the video stream running right now, Facebook, Twitch, YouTube. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any of the shows here on 96.5 The Fan. So let's get started a little differently today. We're going to get to the Royals, I promise, here in about 10 minutes or so.
And glad to see India's in the lineup. That's good news.
That news did just come out, the lineup, literally 2 seconds ago. The lineup was out. India's in it. So means the scary, scary 99-mile-per-hour fastball that hit his helmet obviously was not damaging to his playing time or anything like that. So that was awesome to see. But I do want to start with news in soccer. Sporting Kansas City made a move that I think a lot of fans thought should have happened a year ago, maybe even further than that, if you look back, and that is that Peter Vermes has been let go. They mutually parted ways, how they're phrasing it, with Sporting Kansas City. A couple things with this right out of the gate. Number one, they hadn't won in 195 days. Okay, that's not going to...
When you said that number this morning, I was like, that's how long it's been since they won a match?
They had a draw this year, 0-5-1 in MLS play, but they had not won in 195 days. You just, like, if you want the most simplified way to explain what happened.
No one can keep their job under those conditions, yes.
That's as simply put, not acceptable, right, for any professional franchise. The decision also probably was pressured even more when you see the Cauldron put out a strong statement over the weekend after their latest loss. I'm not saying that's why he got fired, but when you have a fan base and your most diehard supporters asking for the firing of your manager. And then on the other hand, you look back and where Kansas City is at with soccer, and the fact that the World Cup is coming here next summer, that doesn't happen without Peter Vermes. So there's the balance of like recognizing it's time. Like it was time to move in a different direction. But also, he should be someone that's remembered fondly in Kansas City soccer history forever, both as a player and, of course, as a manager, brought an MLS Cup here in 2013. But they just have not had anywhere near the success that they had going back to the first, what would that have been, 7 years or so of his tenure. I believe he was brought in 2009.
Yeah, if the way I view it, you should remember fondly the time he had in Kansas City, right? Like, for all the reasons. They won 3 Open Cups. They won an MLS Cup. They made Kansas City part of like the whole soccer capital of America stuff came from the fact that Sporting Kansas City was really popular and well-liked and people supported them well. I would say that that's what made it easier for teams like the KC Current to come back and do all these things. Like all of that was ground setting for Kansas City to become a city that supported soccer. This firing is 4 years overdue, at least minimum 2. When they extended his contract a couple of years ago, when the writing was already on the wall, that things were going poorly. This decision is way late. I mean, they're way late in the game. I don't want to take away from what he brought to the city or the things that outside of this, but if we're sitting here this morning being like, should they have fired Peter Vermes? Is there a soul left on the planet who thinks that? I compared it, and I still think it's accurate. It's the way Dayton Moore went down. Dayton Moore, hero in the city, turned around a franchise, won a championship, but the last few years were so bad, we can't even let you keep your job, let alone think things are turning around. If they're going to go that poorly, at some point you're out. And that's the way it happened with Vermes.
You could only be loyal for so long. And to what you just said, though, were they ever loyal, because it probably should have been done at least a year or so earlier. And so you sit here today and after the result on Saturday, although I think it was Sam McDowell from the Star, some of his reporting suggesting that this has been in the works for weeks, that perhaps ownership was at some practices more often than they normally were recently, observing, making kind of preparation to make a decision like this. But I know, like, you know, some friends of yours as well, I'm sure, like, that are diehard soccer fans, have had season tickets for Sporting KC, and like a lot of people are saying, just finally, Finally, that was a few of the texts I got today. A lot of people finally. You never want to stomp on somebody's grave, right? That just lost their job, but everybody's relieved almost among fan base. It sounds like that this is finally a move that Sporting KC decided to make, despite everything that they were able to accomplish. But this is the direction that you have to go when you haven't won in 195 days.
I will say this, the frustration I would think if you're a Sporting Kansas City fan, and I certainly would have if, you know, like you're looking at where this team is for the same reason for the NFL comp we've made before. Choosing to let Eberflus screw it all up and then firing in the middle of the year and then resetting is pushing back the reset by a full calendar year. If it was going to be an 0-5-1 start and you were going to walk on Peter Vermes anyway, you should have made this decision last winter. You should have made this decision when the season was over. You should have fired him in the offseason, burned it all to the ground, and rebuilt yourself out of the ashes. And instead, you let yourself get into a season that already feels lost. The team already feels lost. And you let him get his fingerprints all over a team that's going nowhere. And now you got to wait like a whole year to kind of like reset. Interim coaches and all this other stuff. You could have had somebody else's plan starting, and instead you got to ride out now a full MLS season in order to do it. Back to like the because again, I don't think that this is like
and Sporting, by the way,
news.
Saturday they play at Children's Mercy Park, I believe, against St. Louis, and their fans are going to potentially take over Children's Mercy Park. So that was another, this at least, you know, you want to talk about fans. Now that the coach that they did not, manager they did not want being part of the organization anymore is gone, hopefully it almost brings some renewed even support behind the franchise heading into even a game like that. I'm just talking from a rival thing. We all know for many years with the Royals how nobody loves seeing St. Louis fans come over and pack Kauffman Stadium.
Yeah, it sucked.
Doesn't matter what sport you're talking about. You don't want to see that happen, and that's what you're in danger of seeing happen again on Saturday.
I mean, you were getting ready to just lose the entire fan base. And I don't think that the Cauldron were the straw that broke the back on this thing. I think the whole haven't won in 195 days thing might have had something to do with it.
Well, yeah, because a couple years ago, weren't they? Was it a year or two ago? They were holding signs saying to fire him. So this is not the first time that they were asking for this decision.
But those are the fans you can't lose. You know, like in the end, those are the ones you can't lose. Look, from the times that I've covered Sporting, and I've covered them probably 15, 20 times over the years, very easy to get along with, very open, honest with the media. I like those things about it. But I mean, again, it was a wash. I do really genuinely appreciate, though, how he helped grow soccer in this city. Like, I'll you'll be able to look back and be like, wow, what a contribution he made to the entire city and parts of the growth of the city as a result of that. World Cup games will be played in Kansas City a year from now. And part of what he started back then is a reason, not the only reason.
No, but without the success of Sporting Kansas City with him in charge, the World Cup is probably not here in 2026,
agreed,
next year. And I mean, go back to the Wizards day when they were playing at the time T-Bones Park or whatever it was called. You know, it's the Monarchs now, but you know what I'm saying? They were playing there before as they transitioned to Sporting to Children's Mercy Park at the time, Livestrong Park, when it first opened up. Yeah, I know. When it first opened up. But that
like
was
milk.
The thing. Drew may not know the background on that one. But yeah, that was him, right? Like that was where it all began, and they won a title long before the Royals won their World Series in 15, before the obvious dynasty run the Chiefs are on. Sporting was the first local to win in a very, very long time and bring a championship to the city. So you respect to Peter Vermes for what he brought to the city and for soccer in this town. But it was obviously time to move on, and Sporting Kansas City finally made that decision this morning, sending out a press release. And I believe tomorrow there'll be a press conference to talk about steps moving forward for that organization.
Yeah, from the Illig family.
I believe that is right as well. All right, let's get to some Royals baseball. As we said, day game today, right here on 96.5 The Fan. They're in Milwaukee, first road trip, short one, by the way, of the season. They're right back in town this weekend at Kauffman Stadium. The good news, let's start with that, as you alluded to right at the top, Jonathan India is in the lineup despite getting hit in the head. Really, really scary scene for a moment there. Emmanuel Clase, 99-mile-per-hour fastball. So the fact that he's already in the lineup that quickly is honestly, I'm actually surprised, which is a great thing. But you know, you're wondering if you're gonna sit out a day or if there was any lingering effects. Clearly not the case, as India will be leading off today for the Kansas City Royals. Overall, what did you guys make of the opening weekend? 913-586-7965. Because they go 1-2. You never want that. It's a tough division rival.
A team that has
won this division and overall has had your number over the last 5-7+ years. I thought from a starting pitching end, I want to start right there, because from a starting pitching end, you did not get the sharpest of outings from Reagans or from Lugo, but both of them did gut it out enough, as veterans will, to get you. Man. You know, they weren't out after 3 or 4 innings. You know, they were able to gut through and get you 5 innings or so. Maybe not the case yesterday, right? It all kind of fell apart. One of those clunkers of a game where you just had nothing going. But I thought, while you need your starters to be sharper, it's the first outing, I'm not worried about Reagans or Lugo, but they still found a way to at least give you some length, some innings. And then, of course, from an offensive perspective, the questions that we had all offseason showed up in the first series of the year. And that was your batters 5-9, 10 for 56 with 11 strikeouts in the series.
For a team that struck out like the eighth least in the opening weekend in Major League Baseball, yeah, that's not ideal. You would have preferred something a little bit different than that to go with the start of the season. But so the starting pitching was probably the bigger concern, in the sense that, kind of a rocky weekend, but also the most sustainable thing, right? So you're like, well, yeah, the starting pitching didn't go all that great, but history tells me it'll go a lot better here moving forward, so I'm probably fine. 5-9, that was a problem all last year. 162 games. The idea that they're just going to get no production out of there again is concerning. Renfro had a bad weekend. MJ had a bad week. You're like, oh, come on, let's not do this again. And it's early, and I'm not like here to panic or anything after 3 games. But of all the things that probably stood out, that's probably at the top of the list because of the issues that they had with it for a huge chunk of last season. And look, Bobby got off to a slightly slower start. Oh no. I would say Vinny got off to a really good start, which is encouraging. And I think that make you feel a little bit better. The top of the order still feels like it'll probably work. India, by the way, looks like a professional on-base guy. You were talking about like professional on-base guy, man. Every at-bat feels like it takes 10 years. He walks, he hits singles, he just gets on base. I kind of love that. From an opening weekend.
The 0-for-5 opening day, we knew it was an outlier. And then the very next day, his first at-bat is a single. It comes with a couple hits. And yeah, you feel like you do know every single time out what you're going to get. There's a reason why he was tops in the majors in walks. He gets on base. That was the one thing at opening day that I don't, you know, there's 3 or 4 things we listed off on Friday's show of like, hey, you can be concerned about the outfield. You can be concerned about this or that. Don't be worried about Bobby Wood Jr. Don't be worried about Jonathan India. You know, you want to be worried about Renfro and Melendez and the 5-9, more than fair. And if you're still worried about the bullpen, like more than fair, but there's a few guys where they're going to have to struggle a lot longer for me to be concerned about it. I think it's interesting. We've already seen it play out twice now in the first 3 games, and it's very evident. We talked about during spring, and that is like Jonathan India has played left field twice. He came in and he started at third on opening day. Then he moved to left field when they brought in Michael Garcia, who played third. Then in the lineup on Saturday, India was playing left field. Michael was playing third base. And Michael had a nice series.
He did.
Against the Guardians. The lineup is
that
out.
Homer was an absolute missile.
Yes, just got out quick. Now you have it in front of you. I know India's in the lineup. Is he playing third or left field? My point being
up.
Is there, if he's not playing third to start, or even if he is, it feels like now he's going to play left field at some point almost every game, I feel like, at this point. Or
it is at third today.
But will he end up playing left field at some point today? My guess is yes.
Eventually, defensively, they probably make that shift and kind of go that way. But yeah, I would say, like, I think the one thing that I had probably undervalued in what they're going to do is, and J.J. Piccolo actually told us this on opening day, and it wasn't something I had thought about very much, but they are going to pinch run, pinch. They are, like, every day, the 26-man roster, they're going to use all damn 26 of them down to the last couple of dudes. And that's where, like, India's ability to play left or Massey's ability to occasionally play third or left, they're just going to like move people around depending on where they stick them, where they move them, and everything's going to kind of get shuffled because they are going to want to maybe pull MJ Melendez to pinch hit for him, or Renfro depending on the splits, or Canna depending on the splits. Because the other day, They took Salvi from behind the dish, put him at first, got Fermin in the game at catcher. That was in the come-from-behind game, I think, on Saturday. So
And then the lineup yesterday to start had Salvi at first.
Yeah, so like they're just constantly kind of circling around these things. I know we're only three games into the season, so we don't want to make any definitive opinion stand now, except for one. I'd like to make one definitive opinion stand now. Screw that Kyle Manzardo guy. I had never heard of him before. Thursday, and that... Screw that guy! And is he just going to be a huge pain in the ass for the rest of time? I hate that every division team always has one guy that you're like, this guy looks like he should be selling me a used car in 2006. He's just hitting all weekend. Is it because they don't have a scouting report on him, or is Kyle Manzardo just going to be like an absolute force or something? Trust me, you had not heard of him before Thursday, right?
No, that was my point on
He's
Friday.
A rookie or
that
whatever.
Was yeah. This he played last year, but this was his first opening day. On Friday when Bink was filled in, that was my whole thing. People were critical of Q walking Carlos Santana to get to Manzardo, and Manzardo had a great opening day. And my whole thing was, look, I understand he was hot that day, but in game one of 162, I still will go with the matchup based decision, which is what Q went. It backfired, and give the kid credit. You know, and that was my thing. I said, how many of you even knew who Manzardo was? This was on Friday's show, and no reason you should have. So he just had a great weekend. You know, it is what it is. But with Q, in terms of managerial decisions, we should know this by now. We saw it last year, and even in his first year as a manager,
going with the numbers.
They're going to go with numbers, and most of the time, I actually think it will pay off. There are going to be times though where someone bucks the trend or bucks the numbers. Right, it's not 100% foolproof thing. And that's what happened against Manzardo a couple times, specifically on Thursday. But if you're upset with the matchup based decisions, then like I'm part of it. You haven't been paying attention to how they're going to manage games and handle strategy in games. That's what they did last year, and they won 86 games. You know what I mean? Like, so that's just who they are as an organization now, and who he is as a manager. They're going to go 90% of the time with the matchups. I'm not saying later on in the year or in the playoffs that you shouldn't have a mix of feel also with it more. But in game one, when you really have nothing to base off of other than the numbers from the prior year in history, yeah, I'm fine with going pure matchup-based decision-making this early on in the year. Later on in the season, yeah, it can differ a little bit.
Text line saying, hey, don't pitch to the guy who's hot and confident. It's one game.
Hot and confident. He had three at-bats in game one of 162. You cannot be hot.
We have determined he was hot after three at-bats?
Nobody can be hot in game one. Sorry.
I don't even think anybody can be hot. Maybe week one if you're like hitting it like Aaron Judge. Maybe, okay? I'll listen to an argument on that end in those specific circumstances, but certainly not game one for a guy who hit 235 last year in his 53 games.
And they obviously like him. He's a young talent. They probably feel great about him in Cleveland. It's just that, you know, if he keeps hitting like this and they meet again, and they'll meet earlier than this, but it's July. Okay, yes.
Yeah, don't let him murder you.
Have a different feel. But in the first three games of the 2025 season, yeah, I think they're going to go with what the numbers are telling him. I'm fine with that.
In fairness, this is pretty much what he was in the minors. I mean, he was pretty much like a 370 on base guy with real power. He had 37 home runs between two seasons and 177 games in AAA. So, like, that's how it is. I just, like, by the end of the weekend, I'm like, I don't want to see your face
anymore. I think you're jealous that you're jealous he can grow the stash. You can't. I think that's what it is. He can grow the stash, man.
I can grow a stash that looked as
like
good
that?
As
you think?
The one on his baseball reference page, I could. You think I could grow like a terrible looking stash?
No, it's not a great looking one. No, no.
I could grow
not.
A stash that looked as good
can
as Kyle
you?
Manzardo's.
We've tried, I think, on the show. And
I could absolutely
could
grow a stash as good. Look how terrible that stash looks like. It looks like it belongs on a different part of his body. It's not even full. You want me to grow a stash that looks that terrible? That's the level of mustache I could grow. Not better than that. I didn't say it could be better than Kyle Manzardo's, but I could certainly grow. I could grow one that at least looked that good.
Now you were out on Friday. Bink filled in. You were playing Dance Dad. Is that what it was?
Yeah. So obviously my kids, Ruby, my older one, dances, and so like this was an in-town one. Like I got to go out of town later in the year. So there's an in-town one in the Liberty area. She's got another in-town one this weekend, believe it or not. So like multiple times. And I'll say, we need a little decorum at this. So everyone's in a long day situation, right? These dances go from 8 in the morning. If you got an older kid, they go till 10 o'clock at night. They, and look, for the most part, most kids
on a Friday, the competition started at 8 in the morning?
Oh, yeah.
What the heck is going on with this?
Mike, her first dance was at 8, I don't know, 8 something. Huh. It started at 8 a.m. or 9 a.m. That day might have been 9 a.m., but it's pretty early on. So, we're already there. So, it's a long days anyway, right? We're all in the same boat. You got to sit in there. You got to hear little kids' screams for 8 consecutive hours. I get it. We're all on the brink of insanity by the end of this. But on Saturday, my kid's dance studio has a huge production number that comes in this massive stage that they have to, like, bring out and do it because it's, like, 20 people.
Okay.
Friday night, they ask us to help move the stage into the U-Haul. Doesn't fit through the doors because the legs don't turn the right way. So we have to re-engineer it Friday, we have to just take the legs off in the middle so we can get it in the U-Haul. Okay. Saturday, we are stuck in an entire re-engineering project that we weren't planning on because the other people have to dance and they need the stage. So we're like drilling out holes. We're having to like reconfigure the legs so you can like take them off. This whole thing, we're out in the sun for like 3 hours redoing this whole stage part. And this other dad... We're like at the tail end of this.
This other dad.
We're at the tail end of this, and I'm cooked, and they're getting ready to go on stage, and we're just finishing up this. Me and like 3 other dads. And he's like, hey, could you guys get your stuff out of the way? Our stuff's coming off the stage. And he was being rude.
Wait, a dad from another studio or something.
He wanted to move his stuff, and we were slightly in his way. I'm like, listen, pal, he was out there before. You can see that we're.
That you said this to
him? We're getting our ass kicked. I just. I was polite.
Okay.
I just said, we'll move it. Maybe it was not as polite. I just said, we'll move in a second. Like you can wait. I'm sorry you're in such a hurry, sir. All I'm saying is, can we have a little decorum? This guy knows what it's like. We're carrying 80-pound props.
Didn't they have a dance mom reality TV show? They need a dance dad reality TV show for you. It sounds like there's some drama, some arguments that were happening over stages fitting through doors.
I was going to say a new series beginning.
Dance dads.
I think Triple D would be better. Dance Dad Drama. Triple D.
The other thing I'm considering in these dance things is, you know how these people make money? You know, like I've bought a bootleg movie or two. The prices to get your kids.
Yeah, some of this stuff does sound like a complete ripoff.
What? Can I? How well do you think I'd do if I set up a bootleg version of this and then just sold it to these other families?
Don't you have to get like a contract to do it?
No contract. I'm saying I'm going to secretly record it. The people who... You know, do that at, like a movie theater. I'm going to find a way to do it quietly.
You're going to get Ruby in trouble.
It's to do the entire studio. So like every kid's dance. So it's, you know, like 20 people, however many dances, right? To do every kid's dance, it's like for the weekend, it's like $1,200.
That's how much.
$1,200.
The guy video. Hold on. Who's paying $1,200?
The studio or us, right? Oh, we would be paying it.
To enter the competition or film?
To just get video of my kid dancing.
Hold on, whoa,
$1,200?
To just get video of my kid dancing. $500 to $1,000.
All right, so
that's crazy.
So as you're speaking, we've figured out the whole scheme here. So it's great that your daughter's in the dance competition, but the real moneymaker, the whole setup of this whole thing is they're hoping you're going to spend $500 on video of your daughter's performance. Outrageous.
And they're like, hey, no cell phone video. I'm like, stop me. What if I buy like a high quality pinhole cam and I just like get video of my kid dancing for the rest of the time?
Didn't you
right?
complain about the video stuff a year ago?
I think it's getting higher priced.
It's even higher.
I think it feels like inflation. I think it is higher than what I think for some reason 300 comes to mind for last year.
Did you buy video of your daughter?
Nope. I'll just wait till nationals.
What did you tell Ruby when she said, Dad, how come
I didn't get
video?
She didn't ask to see it, so.
Well, then you're good. Until she asks, don't buy one.
Hang on.
Until she asks, don't buy it.
I didn't pay for it.
If it's $500 now, how much will it be at nationals then?
I mean, I got to assume it's a comparable price. Different company, so I can't say for sure. It's not the
maybe
same.
Maybe that's what you don't need to do a bootleg. You need to find out how you just start your own company and get the contracts and just make a lot of money.
And then just have my kids for free?
Cody and Gold video. Drew and I will go to these competitions as well if we can just make a bunch of money. It sounds like we got money to be made here.
You need to be the video company.
That's where the money's at, I guess.
How many kids are in this all day? Are we talking 1,000 kids?
I've got no idea. I don't know.
Because if you were to say there's 1,000 kids.
Ours is one of the smaller studios, and it probably has 20, but some of the studios probably have 50 kids.
Okay. If there's 1,000 kids, let's say every family actually spent the $500, that's
a huge moneymaker.
I think
there
are probably 400 total dances. So if you do the math and it's like $30 per dance, which is the math of like every kid for the $1,200, you'd probably be talking $12,000.
All right, so that's just the video. Now, what's the rough cost to enter? Like, how, like for you to like enter?
Oh, hundreds of dollars. I, you know, like that just goes in our studio fees. I don't even know.
Goodness.
I don't think I want to know what the studio. Probably $400 or $500. I don't mean. You know, I don't know.
Someone said they spent $23,000 last season on
That's
dance
insane.
For their girls.
What?
Not including
no way.
Not girls including travel. Yeah, yeah, I don't know. Two, three, I don't know. But it said that from the 816, not including travel and lodging.
Someone says get those Meta glasses that record.
I mean, no, that'd be pretty hilarious.
Honest to God, That's those what are what, $500?
That's what you should do.
I get the glasses, I'm good for life. I can record them forever.
You should do that.
Dude, are we kidding? It's not the worst plan.
So it costs more money. I don't have kids, but growing up and playing sports, I don't think it was costing my parents anywhere in the tens of thousands
Look,
of dollars.
I, certainly. Travel baseball might now.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I don't think it's that like unheard of. It's just it's still insane. Like, I have two sisters, and they both did dance growing up and stuff. Now they didn't do as much of the competition dance stuff, so they didn't have the travel. But still, even just the normal dance stuff, I remember was outrageous. But you're right. Like, if you are on a travel baseball team. Some of you that are listening, I'm sure your son maybe is on that. Like the
guarantee, someone spent $20,000 doing that last year.
That's just wild.
Has the cost gone up that much?
Yes.
I might be wrong, but I don't think my parents spent that much money on doing AAU.
Well,
stuff
back then, maybe not.
But so like travel baseball when I was a kid, I'd play like 80 games in the summer. Travel baseball when I was a kid was we went to Harrisonville or Peculiar, at worst maybe the border of Iowa. Travel ball now is we've got our tournament upcoming in Jamaica. We'll see you there for a 7-day weekend. So like it's just a different system.
Someone says the whole dance industry is a scam. I mean, look, some of it definitely sounds like doing it. I totally get it. But it's like, holy cow, the dollar amount is insane just for the video. All right, up next, though, let's talk about the biggest story in sports right now other than the NCAA tournament. It has to do with the bat that I thought was like made up that you bought at a toy store years ago. We'll explain that next. All right, back here on Cody and Gold, Alex Gold, Cody Tapp, Drew Nixon with you. The biggest story in sports has to do with like if the name of the bat sounds like just like one of those Nerf bats, the torpedo bat, but it's a real thing. How this, I guess, wasn't talked about in spring training beats me. Like, were the Yankees not using torpedo bats in spring training? Was it only used opening
series? It was like a secret weapon they were waiting?
So for those who haven't paid attention, the Yankees are using something called torpedo bats. And we'll play the explanation of it in a second. But the reason why this also got a ton of attention is because the Yankees all weekend against the Brewers raked. Now, they were also playing in New York.
15 home runs, the most in a three-game series in Major League Baseball history, or franchise history.
Yeah. 15. So they were raking, and it was at Yankee Stadium, which we all know the dimensions are shorter. It was windy on opening day, too. They're also playing a Brewers team that we don't know how good they're going to be, but they certainly aren't the LA Dodgers, so keep that in mind. But here's a quick explanation on what is going on with these bats that look different and might be causing some more offense.
Now, you see the shape of Chisholm's bat?
I do. It's got a big barrel on it.
Well, it's actually a little bit lower than the barrel. The Yankee front office, the analytics department, did a study on Anthony Volpe, and every single ball it seemed like he hit on the label. He didn't hit any on the barrel. So they had bats made up where they moved a lot of the wood into the label, so the harder part of the bat is going to actually strike the ball.
That'd be a weird way to hit. Going up there expecting to get jammed and putting the meat of the bat towards the label?
It'd allow you to wait a little bit longer.
Yeah, you wait all right.
That's the audio from Yes Network, by the way, one of the Yankees games over the weekend, explaining this torpedo bat. It's blown up. It's like, other than maybe the Final Four, it's the biggest story in sports right this second. And are other teams now going to mimic this? First and foremost, I get it if your first thought is this cheating?
Yeah. Yeah, that my initial instinct is, are you cheating? Because there are firm rules in there about experimental bats and whether or not you're allowed to do experimental bats and all this other stuff. But also, they have dimensions, right? So it's like, hey, the barrel cannot be larger than this size in this area. So like, they are technically within the rules.
Yeah, maybe baseball approved it. They had to get permission.
Yeah, you're not allowed to just bring a new weirdo bat into a game. You have to tell baseball you're going to do it first. Baseball approved it, and obviously for the Yankees' sake, it is working.
Is it working, or is it just it's three games against the Brewers in their stadium and it was windy on opening day?
I'll say it is three games. So there's no reason to just like, I don't think you need your favorite players. I don't think we need to go send Michael Massey to the bat store and say, hey, man, just real quick, go ahead and pick up a couple of these bad boys and let's call it a day. I don't think we need to rush to the store and figure out, or like, you know, someone just mentioned travel baseball. Every travel baseball kid rushed to the store to go get a Torpedo bat before their upcoming wood bat tournament. But I do think, I think it's kind of fairly obvious that there must have been some advantage in it. And the logic and the explanation behind the advantage makes sense. And talking to some members of the Royals organization, I think it's less about the Yankees all figure this out and that the bat manufacturers have been actually pitching this for years, have been doing all this research and been producing these bats, and they just straight up weren't popular for a while. I'm going to guess that's getting ready to change. And if this continues for even 2 weeks, honestly, you'd be kind of a fool if you were a player who was struggling and it was hitting in that part of the bat in particular. Look, if you're Bobby Wood Jr. and you're already hitting, or Vinny, you're already hitting, I don't know, you need to go change up your bat style. But if you find out that that's where you're regularly making contact, I don't know why you wouldn't try it. This seems like free money. It does feel like cheating. It feels like one of those things like the tush push where you're like, I don't like it. And I kind of prefer that you just have to swing a regular bat. Well,
that, and of course it's the Yankees. That's the other part. Like, it's not like the Royals, you know, it's not like the Royals or Brewers are the first team using it. Like, oh, wow, okay. No, of course it's the Yankees. And you know, yes, you can talk about resources within an organization and all of this, but this is not the first time anybody in baseball has ever heard of this. It's just the first time that the masses and those of us that are just fans of the game are hearing about these Torpedo bats. And now it really is the biggest story, and everybody's trying to figure out how much does it actually impact. I think deep down, the impact of it is overblown. Like, that's just my...
I agree. It's just like a bad series that got away.
I think it... Does it help? I think it probably does, but I think to the extent is overblown. This is not like some secret power-up. You know, you're playing some video game. You know, for those of you that download the new Backyard Baseball throwback game...
I can't just put my sliders on 99 and have slug homers all the time.
Yeah, it's not that. You still got to square the ball up in a lot of things, but maybe it increases the distance. Like, use these bats in the Home Run Derby, please. Maybe that it does something like that. But you're right. If the next week or so the Yankees are still hitting at an abnormal rate of home runs and power with these bats, then you would be foolish as an organization, as a player, not to really, really explore this. And so we'll see what the Yankees do this week. But it is kind of wild that that this just blew up the way it did so, so quickly. And whether you're, you know, Louisville Slugger there in Louisville, Kentucky, making bats, and not everybody uses that, right? Like, Bobby has a different brand, manufacturer for his bats than somebody else does, or somebody has this manufacturer. But if you're a manufacturer of those bats, you're definitely, I bet you, if we got an honest answer, whether it's Louisville or you pick your bat manufacturer, that they have gotten some requests, to say the least.
Yeah.
To say the least. Hey, send me, you know, Send me like two or three of these. I just want to
swing it in the cage a little bit before the game and see how it feels.
Do you guys think Vinny's done that? Because I think Vinny, when he joined us the last time that he joined us, he was on his way home from Louisville Louisville Slugger.
I'm going to ask him. I haven't. We'll see what he says when we ask him, but I'll ask him. If you're curious if the Royals are intrigued by this, Q was talking about it. Matt Quatrero, the Royals manager. This is what he had to say about it.
Well, good for them. I mean, that's creativity. That's using all your resources, right? I mean, you want to combine your resources with your experience, and it certainly is not something I could have used it. I never hit it on the sweet spot, so I certainly didn't think about it either. So good for them. I mean, you know, I'm sure if that's legal and other people find that to be the case, that, you know, somebody else is going to do it as well. So, you know, I did see the video of it yesterday. The home runs were before our game start, or a lot of them were before our game started, so I was aware of what was going on, but I did not hear about the bat until this morning. But yeah, I would imagine it becomes a trend now.
I mean, this could very well just be Yankee Stadium, small stadium.
That's what I'm saying. I think it's overblown.
But the trend is going to be kind of hard. There's going to be players who are tempted by it, especially players, because it's the bat speed thing for me. It's the players who consistently can't turn over the ball and hit it on the sweet spot and get their bat around on. If you're just moving it, then you just don't care that you get pitched inside nearly as much.
Yeah, let's just see what this week brings. But I think it is very important to point out, specifically opening day, and the reaction was at Yankee Stadium. I believe it was very windy that day, and it was against the Milwaukee Brewers. And Cortez got rocked, just rocked. He might just be old and washed. I don't know, right? Like, so let's see. But I'm fascinated by it, though. Like, it is really, I don't know how many articles you read as well. Like, it's just interesting to read up on it and how we got here, why the Yankees are here. They got this guy from MIT, they claim, is like the source of all of it. And there's people that dispute that. But, like, it's really interesting. But I'm skeptical that it's as big of a deal as, frankly, everybody, and here we are talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, it was the biggest story in sports probably over the weekend, and for, I think, pretty good reason. So, yeah, I mean, it's just one of those, like, give me 2 weeks, and then I'll give you a sense. But the first Royals player shows up with a torpedo bat, I'm interested. If MJ Melendez comes in to pinch hit today, and all of a sudden, he's got one, I'm curious. I want to, and he hits a homer?
Well,
I mean, geez. Then the story just kind of takes, it could just be Yankee Stadium is a joke. It's 313 down the line, and maybe specifically a bat like that would help them even more. Think about it. You jammed on the inside, more likely to be pulling it on that case, down that, what is it, 311, 313, something down the left field line. Like, it could be that it helps them more. I mean, 15 home runs in three games is ludicrous. That is a ludicrous number. How many home runs do the Royals have? Two? Is it two? How many do they have in the first three games?
I think that's right. Vinny obviously had the one on opening day.
Yeah. So, I mean, the
idea. Mikel's got the other one, yeah, I think. Yeah.
The idea that some team's out there with 15 is kind of ludicrous. I will say one player in particular, and we'll talk more about the Royals. And if you missed it, we just talked about Peter Vermees being let go by Sporting Kansas City. We'll bring that back up at 11:30. We got to hand things off to Vern at noon today as we get ready for a Royals day game. It's Brewers opening day. So the Royals will be playing some baseball today at 1 o'clock with Vern's on deck starting at noon. One player, though, we talked about the guys who start slow historically and have consistently started slow and what it would mean to get a good start. Our guy, Vinny Pasquantino. Like, he last year hit 206 in April. He had a 270 on base percentage. The first few weeks, I can't remember how long, it was like a week before he even got an extra base hit. That's why we did Pasquantino live.
On April 7th last year, Vinny still had not had an extra base hit.
So, like, that's why we did Pasquantino live and all the fun, like, stuff that came with it. I love seeing him post-thumb surgery, full off season. He obviously has made a huge point of his health. He's still dealing with a hamstring injury, so, like, that's not even fully healed. He still managed to get on third yesterday, thankfully, to his own. But for a guy with 208 last year with a 311 on-base percentage and a 386 slug, it was the worst month of the season for him by a mile. Not close. For him to be already hitting well out of the gate, I think that's really important for their offense. That's why they start slow some years, because even their good hitters aren't hitting in the early part of the year, not just 5 through 9.
No, no doubt. And he's one of the three guys that carried the offense a year ago. So if you're able to get going early on in the season, it's why, not that Bobby has been ice cold, but he hasn't had the first three games. Again, let's put it all in perspective.
Yeah.
Three games, first three games that you would expect out of him. But it's so weird to even say that, because it's so early that even saying, I'm laughing as I'm saying it out loud, because it's hard to take it too seriously of, well, you know, the first three games, that, you know, Bobby he wasn't hitting like he usually does. It's three games. He'll be fine. But you're right. If the alternative you like, which is what Vinny's doing, which is hitting really well right out of the gate, it beats what we're seeing maybe for some other players that are a little slow. But yeah, let's see it carry over. They go on the road. They're in an indoor environment today in Milwaukee too. So you're not in the cold weather city yet.
Sure.
from a stadium where you're dealing with that, and that can temper your offense. We hear that all the time. Oh, wait till June when things warm up. Well, opening day was 80 degrees at Kauffman.
Saturday
was pretty nice, and then yesterday was cold, and then today they're in an indoor environment or a retractable roof environment in Milwaukee.
Vinny was on, like, probably, like, if we had done a list of the three players I thought most important start well this year, the other two guys would have been, like, concerning players. Guys who have started slow but have also just never come around as, like, productive, consistent big league players, like MJ Melendez, would have probably been number one from an offensive perspective. Vinny still would have been in the top three. Because you mentioned what was true last year, where Vinny, Salvi, and Bobby did carry this offense for 162 games last year. But Vinny, it was really just two guys carrying it for the first 30. And not that they didn't, it's not that they were, like, in the drudges or falling apart, but what happened in the first series here, which is the pitching starts a little bit slower. So you need a few more guys getting you a few more runs here early. Last year, they were winning every game 2-1. Salvi would get an RBI, Bobby'd get an RBI, and then they just hang out and wait for Waka to close it down or Reagan's to close it down. They might have to win 4-3, which means one more guy in the offense, 5-4, one more guy in the offense kind of going while the starting pitching maybe resettles back to what they did last year versus not like the worst start of all time, but slower start than we saw last year.
And they'll take on a Brewers team starting today. You mentioned it's their opening day. I think they got to an 0-4 start after taking on the Yankees. So they're going to be, you know, no team wants to start 0-2, let alone 0-4. So the Brewers will be looking for their first win, but you're not facing the top of their pitching staff or anything like that. So we'll see if the Royals, who are slight favorites today, who will have Jonathan India in the lineup. If you're just joining us, that's the good news. Despite the scary pitch that hit him in the head from Emmanuel Clase yesterday, he's back in the lineup. Now, I thought, thinking of Vinny, Vinny had some comments about Jonathan India getting hit yesterday.
My view of it was watch him get hit in the face. And I'm still kind of collecting my thoughts on it, but he threw a pitch that he doesn't ever throw, the pitch before, which was a four-seam fastball. It was his first one of the year. And then the next pitch, they, you know, trying to come back up and in with the next pitch. You know, and you got to get it. You're trying to let a pitch ride, and it didn't. And it hit him right in the face after almost hitting him in the face the pitch before. So, obviously, I'm upset by it. I'm more upset for John because, I mean, we don't know what's going on with him right now. So, it sucks, and I don't think there's any. Do I think there was intent behind it? Absolutely not. He's trying to go close a ball game, finish a ball game. It did happen, and that sucks a lot. And it felt like there was a lot of, and again, scouting reports, different ways of pitching. You got to own the inside part of the plate. It felt like we were moving quite a lot this weekend. Again, I don't think I know there wasn't any intent behind it, but felt like there was no adjustment made there, and that's frustrating. But again, they beat us. Hats off to them. It's a sucky situation.
So that was Vinny Pasquantino. I believe that was from FanDuel Sports Network after the game yesterday. And since then, we now know, fortunately, Jonathan India is all right. He is back in the lineup. But that's wild that the four-seam fastball, he threw it one time last year, Class A, and he threw it. And that's not the pitch that hit him, but that was the pitch before that hit him.
And then he tried to go inside again. I get Vinny's point, which is a little bit like, they have all the control in this situation. I have to just be reactionary. But like, how far inside are they allowed to go if they've got no command? And what point as a pitcher, just for the safety of the person you're facing, if you don't have it, do you like, no, I'm going to keep trying to go inside till I what? Crush this guy's temple? Like, that was a scary, scary hit. The initial reaction was like, oh, man, India might have to miss a couple of games here at best. Like, maybe it's a concussion.
Fortunately, it got him in the right part of the helmet, right? Like, it got him in the right part of the helmet, and he's able to be in the lineup today. I mean, you're worried about a broken jaw. You're worried about all kinds of things. You just don't know. And he is ready to roll, though, today against the Milwaukee Brewers. We'll get into some college basketball. The Final Four is set. You and I have differing opinions on what this Final Four is going to be and the matchups and just the makeup of it. That's coming up in 12 minutes or so. But locally, the story right now is just how many guys are in the transfer portal from the University of Kansas. Another one just
entered. And Ryland Griffin,
as we were talking on the show today. So I think when we discussed the Kansas basketball season a few weeks ago, we said they were probably going to have a pretty strong reset. You know, there's maybe two guys that are coming back kind of thing. So guys transferring, not surprising. Like Ryland Griffin entering the portal, Coy entering the portal, probably not surprising. The one that this weekend was surprising, and he could still come back, although I'm not sure, is Florey. So his guardian put out a statement to the Kansas City Star, and it seemed a little conflicting, but like their goal is to still end up coming back to Kansas. So then you think, okay, is it a leverage play for more money to show that he can get X amount on the open market?
Because he seemed like one of the few guys you actually wanted back.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to any Kansas basketball fan. There was reason. A lot of people wanted him to play more this year, and KJ Adams was playing over him. So, no, this is a guy that if you're going to have a reset, he needs to be part of the reset. Are they really not going to be able to retain him? I don't buy that it's going to be because of money. That's the one thing that I want to reiterate for those that are suggesting that in the NIL era, KU now is just can't compete or whatever. Look, you want to be critical of the coaching from Bill Self, player development, getting the right guys. That's all fair game, and they have not done that well. We've said it over and over. But acting like that they're not getting the top tier talent anymore, that's just false. Like AJ Storr was a top transfer. He just didn't work out.
Hunter Dickinson was a top
top money guy.
Zeke Mayo was a all top transfer.
So it's not like they can't find. They have the money.
They've not been finding the right guy.
They haven't found the right guy. And you got to wonder in this scenario, if Flory ends up leaving, how much does it matter that in January when he was playing better than KJ Adams, Bill Self went back to KJ Adams and took care of his guy in that regard. So that's what's interesting. I still think there is a chance he comes back to university, but this would be the stunner. Ryland Griffin transferring is not stunning.
David Coit doesn't move the needle for you?
No.
Here's the one thing, though, is that now they are officially at the entire remaining Kansas roster is in the portal. Like, all of them. He doesn't have a starting three if he wanted to do it. So for all the people
but
that
I'm fine
questioning,
with that, other than Flory, I'm fine. I mean, the team was bad last year. I'm fine. I mean, it should be a reset as long
that
as Flory comes back.
Like, you know, we always kind of put it a little
standard.
By KU standard, yes. I mean, they were still like mediocre at worst, probably.
But that's not
going to
get it done at Kansas.
No, it's
you know?
Not. I would. Here's the thing. For anybody who is questioning the first off the notion, it's like because now you can't pay people behind closed doors. I would actually encourage you. There's a lot of articles out right now because the way that NIL is shifting. There's still a lot of behind closed doors payments because the way these like caps and all this stuff is going to work, people are still going to find shady ways to pay players. So if you think that's going away, it's just not. So we'll just start there. Cheating's going to continue. But the other part about this is that Bill Self, this will be the single best offseason he's ever had to prove any of the NIL doubters wrong. He is going to start with a 100% pretty much from scratch roster, maybe 5% from what he was working with last year. It's going to be a huge transfer portal class, maybe Flory, and then a couple of high-level prospects.
Yeah, number one, number two player in the country.
Derek Peterson's going to start. He's going to be your best player.
Yeah, but like you are starting from bare-bones scratch. This is the most blank starting position I've seen in a Kansas team ever, which means a chunk of it's going to have to come from the portal again.
Oh yeah,
and I'm going to guess they're going to be one of the highest spending teams in the portal again. Who are the number one? Who's expected to be the number one portal player?
Dude, there's like 2,000 players in the portal right now, and that's not even exaggerating.
RJ Lewis or Luis, I would say from St. John's is right now graded as
Dent, Dent from New Mexico is very high on the list.
He's already committed though.
Has he already decided that he's going?
He went to UCLA.
Really? Not Kentucky. Everybody thought he was going to Kentucky.
It was Kentucky, Gonzaga, and UCLA.
According to 24/7, Adrian Woolley from Kennesaw State is their number one.
I think he's the guy that KU has reached out
Thomas
to.
Thomas from UNLV. Josh Dix, who already committed somewhere, didn't he?
I don't think Dix has committed anywhere yet. No.
Okay.
Owen Freeman, who was a transfer from Iowa, committed to Creighton.
Point like, being, I'll be honest. Yes, of the 10 guys on this list, right, I don't care if it's the kid from Virginia or all these other guys we just mentioned from Xavier or whatever. I would almost bet blindly to anybody who thinks Kansas doesn't spend in the portal without even knowing anything about where they are in the mix. I would almost bet blindly that of the top 10 transfer portal kids, 24/7 list right now, that Kansas lands one of them. Like I would bet $50 blindly to somebody, assuming that one of these top 10 portal kids is going to Kansas because like the money's not the problem. The question is whether or not Bill Self can actually build a team again.
And if it fits the system that he runs, because that's the thing is, yeah, you get AJ Storr, but he didn't. It didn't work to just compile four or five of the best players in the portal and just throw them together. It just didn't work. So
yeah, they have to reevaluate. And like we played the comments after the loss to Arkansas. I do think they recognize they have to do it differently. They're not just like, oh, no, we can just do the same thing and figure it out. I've told you I think they need to actually have some new pieces on the coaching staff as well. I know he has a bunch of longtime assistants that have had plenty of success. They just won a national title together in 2022. But I think that's an area to look. We've talked about the GM role. More and more programs are doing that. I think Kansas could use, as most programs could, a general manager. But the Flory transfer portal
that'd be a tough
flirtation
loss.
It was the stunner. These other names are not.
And I think you're right, Gold. It's not money related. Again, he's from Indiana. Was originally, I believe, committed to IU before. It sounds like he either wants to move closer to home and go to a place like IU, or it's Kansas. For the people that think it's Missouri, sorry, it's not happening. It's not going to happen.
Everybody can dream for a little bit, you know?
Sure.
Yeah, let them dream for a little bit.
Hey, and I'd love Florida to go to Wisconsin, but that's not happening, you know?
You want your Badgers to get him?
Yeah, they've been.
He looks like there's no reason.
Well.
Honestly, he should have been. The problem is that this is like the Chiefs with a veteran player, veteran linebacker. We've had these arguments a million times. Bill Self goes with the trusted whether you like it or not. And KJ's not a bad player. He's just a limited player. And I think sometimes that's the problem. It's like, he's limited. He's not going to screw up the whole world for you. He's a limited player. And when you see a guy in Flory who's on the bench and you're like, he's not a limited player and there's a huge ceiling, I'd like the ceiling, please. Even if there's times in which he'd play worse.
Particularly on defense, you know, after Hunter Dickinson, you know, sometimes, for lack of a better term, was a no-show defensively.
Yeah. I mean, the Hunter Dickinson, we've talked about him. It's the reason why he was in college still.
Yeah, he's a really good player, but yeah. You're
really,
right.
really good college player. That's what he is.
And he's never played in the NBA.
And he'll play over. Yeah, he'll make great money overseas somewhere, I'm sure. But yeah, there's a reason why he wasn't in the NBA. We saw it play out again this year. All right, up next, I want to talk about the four teams left. The final four is set. You and I disagree on what this matchup is going to be for both games on Saturday and how we got here. We'll get into that. Plus, we'll work in a trash of the day coming up next here on Cody and Gold. 11 o'clock hour here on Cody and Gold. A reminder, day baseball today. The Royals are in Milwaukee.
Hell
Verne's
yeah.
On deck show at noon right here on your home for KC Sports. 96.5 The Fan. Couple Royals notes before we get into some Final Four discussion. The Royals lineup did come out earlier today. Jonathan India is leading off, is playing third base. So great news after that scary scene against Cleveland yesterday. Also, just moments ago, the Royals made a roster move. Tyron Blanco, unfortunately, placed on the 10-day IL, right Achilles. I don't know if it's tendonitis, but it's something with his right Achilles. And then Tyler Tolbert has been selected from AAA Omaha.
Who's also very fast, if you're curious. Ian Kraft, who works over the Royals, in the media department, said this stat: Tolbert brings elite speed to the Royals since his pro debut. So since he like started in the minors and was a professional baseball player in 2019, he has stolen 243 bases. He's only been caught 16 times. Jeez.
So he's going to fill that same role right there. The same role right there.
So most bases stolen out of any professional baseball player and the minor league level. Second was Estuary Ruiz, a former Kansas City Royal who they traded to the A's, and Tyron Blanco, the guy who we just got called up for. So if you're curious if Tolbert can steal bases late, the answer is yes.
All right, so just a small move there. Hopefully it's a short stint for Tyron Blanco, but it looks like they've got somebody that can fill that exact same type of role.
He'll always have that crown bat, you know, the crayon bat week when he...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was the yellow, right?
Yeah.
Wasn't it a yellow bat? That was crazy. But what's so funny about it, like, it just reminds you, like, how early we are in the season now, and then also that short period of time. Because there were legitimate people that said, because of that week, and they thought, oh, he needs to play way more. It's like... We can. There's certain players that are great role players and stuff, and that's just
those.
Hey, you can have a great MLB career doing that for a long time, but doesn't mean they need to play now 95 games or 100 games. You know, we've said that over and over. All right, I want to talk a little college basketball. Final Four is set in San Antonio for starters, which we've talked about. I think it is the best Final Four site based off the Riverwalk. I would put San Antonio, New Orleans, and Vegas. Drew's shaking his head. He wants to throw Indy. In fairness, I haven't been to Annapolis, so I can't say yes
or
no.
It's not his personal ranking system.
So it doesn't fall. I've been to a Final Four in New Orleans. I've been to San Antonio on the Riverwalk, and we've obviously been to Vegas. So
They got a good reputation as a host city.
It's hosted a lot of big-time events, but those three cities would be my rotation. So I'm excited that it's in San Antonio because it's a great scene on the Riverwalk with the different fan bases. And then now, for the second time since expansion, Final Four has all four number one seats. I'll be honest, I love it. I love the fact that we get the four number one seats. This was a year where throughout the season, when we talked college hoops, we said, hey, this seems like a year where there's a clear cut. At first, it was just Auburn and Duke, better than everybody else. And then Florida got hot late in the year, like maybe Florida's the best team in the country. Well, all four, and here's why I like it, all four, you can make a case. Maybe you don't agree with the opinion, but you can make a case all four could really win the national title. That's not like a crazy thought. All four teams, Duke and Houston and Florida and Auburn, can all win the title. And the matchups that we're going to get, the Duke-Houston one, number one offense in Duke, number one defense in Houston. I just love that and what that sets up matchup-wise. And then Florida and Auburn, two best teams in the best conference in college basketball here in 2025, the SEC, Florida Auburn. So I'm excited. We get great matchups. And I'll be honest, I might be in the minority overall. Like, I love the upsets early on. We didn't get that. But when it comes down to this, for the second time in Final Four history, we get all four number one seeds. That's awesome. I would rather see Duke play Houston than Duke take on 12 seed Florida Atlantic, where they're going to be 9.5 or 10-point favorites. I don't. It's a great story. I don't want the blowout in the Final Four, and I don't think we're getting that.
So here's the thing. That is, I think it might be wishful thinking to say, and I don't think we're getting that, because the only first, this has been an awful tournament. Just flat out boring as hell. There are like five decent games in the entire thing. It has stunk. And the same argument you're making for the number one seeds is the exact argument you could have made for the Elite Eight. 1-2, 1-2, 1-2, and 1-3. Games stunk, 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 and stunk. They all stunk. None of them were close. One got close at the end, kind of, with Ole Miss. No good games in the Elite Eight, even though it was the top. It was seven of
you're ignoring
the top
the Sweet 16,
eight
though.
Seeds.
You're ignoring the Sweet 16, which was really, really good. I don't know if you watched them, but Sweet 16 was great.
I did watch some of the Sweet 16, and like that's, but like the Elite Eight, like the same argument for like all four ones, we're going to get good games now. We should have gotten good games for the Elite Eight, and we got zero.
No, because I push back on that because we said throughout the season that the top two teams in the country were probably Auburn and Duke. Now they're going to actually potentially face off with each other. Nobody thought that Duke and Tennessee or Houston and Tennessee, that Tennessee was the same class of team as those. That's the point. These four have been the best teams in the country for 90%, at least two of them 90%, the other two maybe 60% of the season. That's what I get what you're saying. The matchups in the Elite Eight, higher seed versus higher seed, sure. My argument is that these four are clearly the best and have been for most of the year. Now they're facing off. Tennessee, very evidently, not anywhere near the same class as any of the four teams neither was Michigan State.
I hope you're, look, I'm not disagreeing that these were at any point the top four seeds, but I'm just saying it's not guaranteeing us good games.
Well, I'm not guaranteeing it. I'm saying on paper, these are from an intrigue and an excitement level. I'm way more excited if you told me that it's Duke versus Houston, which it is, versus Duke against Wofford or Duke against Florida Atlantic. That would not be exciting to me because I've seen that play out. It's not even just the result of the game. I'm talking about the buildup this week. I am genuinely excited to get to Saturday night. A couple years ago, I was not excited knowing that I keep using Florida Atlantic, but like, because they obviously went on a run, but pick any 12 plus seed that did not excite me going in knowing they were likely to get their ass kicked.
Yeah. And look, and someone's mentioning like Texas Tech versus Florida. It was a Sweet 16 game. I didn't say that wasn't a good game.
It was a great game. Arkansas, great game. Texas Tech went to overtime. Did it
but
not?
But there are, I didn't say there were zero good games in the tournament. I said there were five and those in the Sweet 16. I'm saying in the Elite Eight, the game stunk. You're ignoring those and going to the Sweet 16. Sweet 16 had a couple of good games. No doubt. Not arguing it.
You said,
definitely
well, the reason why I'm pointing out, you said it's the worst tournament you can remember.
It is an awful tournament.
So.
In my opinion, it was an awful tournament.
That's fun.
Like some of that is like a volume game. When we point out the like seven games in the tournament were good out of 90, I'm like, that's a bad ratio. I would say under normal tournaments, I think we get more good games than that. But because of the sheer lack of just, there were no upsets the whole way. There were very few in the round of 64, very few in the round of 32, very few in the round of 16, none in the Elite Eight. And there can't be in the final four, really, because of the one seeds, obviously. Not that you need an upset then. Now
I agree with the upsets.
Games.
The upsets typically happen in the first two rounds anyway. And those did not happen this year. I'm not disagreeing with you that we didn't have. We said that at the time that the first weekend of the tournament, Thursday and Friday, were underwhelming. I'm with you. That was not a good Thursday, Friday from a excitement level and when wanting buzzer beaters or wanting the upsets. We didn't get that.
Maybe they can save it with the final four because the Sweet 16 to this point is the only round that's mattered. Because, 64-32, we didn't get it. Elite Eight, I think we have to agree we didn't get it, right? There was no, three of them were blowouts, and one was like Ole Miss trying to make a late run, and it didn't matter.
I think it's not as much about like the, it's more about the matchups and the way that they play. Like Alabama shoots 75% of their shots are threes. They were off against Duke, because Duke has a really good defense, and as a result, Alabama got smacked. I mean, Tennessee couldn't make an open shot to save their life against a really good Houston defense. They got smacked. Like, I don't, that doesn't mean that the matchup was bad or that I think it comes down to they didn't make their shots. And
yeah, but it's no different than like, McNeese State got their ass kicked. I mean, you shot bad, I mean, it was a bad match. I don't know, Drew. I think it might have just been a bad matchup. To Gold's point, actually, the four teams were probably just a step ahead of literally everyone else. Look, maybe they can redeem themselves with three outstanding games to wrap it up, right? And your wish comes true and that we get that where Duke and Houston is an absolute, like, epic game. And on the other side, Florida and Auburn's an epic game. And then we get an epic national championship. And then the tournament might feel different to me then. It might.
Yeah, I just
at this
like,
point, it's been a dumb
I hate, where, I hate the
to.
Standard, though, that we're now, I guess, setting before we even head into Saturday, which is, like, for it to be great now, Duke has to win on a Cooper flag last-second three, and they have to storm the court. Like, that's, I'm not saying we're going to have a Disney movie in the Final Four
No, I'm
this
just
weekend.
Saying a good game.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I haven't had we didn't have a good game in the last round. Well, and the one before, we had a couple, there's no doubt.
Did we have this conversation last year when the Final Four happened and UConn obliterated everybody along the way. We didn't have this conversation.
It's a better tournament up to that point.
And the national title game is a 20-point game. The national title game, according to what people are talking about with this tournament, it sucked. Like I don't, but everybody was celebrating UConn and how I feel like the conversation around this season is so much more different, and it doesn't make any sense.
You and I are aligned, but in fairness,
last year.
You and I are aligned for the most part, but in fairness to Coach, I think he is probably in the majority opinion. Like the reason why the tournament is great, casual fans don't pay attention. Like most of us don't pay attention to college basketball till now, and so you expect the upsets in Thursday and Friday of that first weekend, and you expect
and more good games. Yeah.
And so I don't think you're in the minority opinion at all on this. I think you're probably a majority.
I
think though the way the tournament, there's a lot of people like I would rather have the best teams in the Final Four. I don't think that's the majority opinion at all.
I kept trying to go back to the Elite Eight. Like I kept trying to watch the games. And I'm like a useless Elite Eight to watch. Unless you had bets on it, there was no point tuning in.
To Cody's point, if you're going to watch a blowout, like the same thing I think in college football exists. If I'm going to watch a blowout and I know it's going to happen, I would rather see the Cinderella get their ass kicked than see one of the, than see a power. I get that side of things. I think I totally get it. Look, if the Elite Eight delivered and it was all single digit games, I think it's really hard to argue. I'd rather have a Cinderella team in there. But you watch Alabama play Duke and you're like, you know what? I'd rather have seen throw anybody in there. VCU. I'd rather see VCU. I'd rather see UNC Wilmington play Duke and lose the way that Alabama did rather than Alabama get beat the way that they did. I think that I get it.
Yeah, no, I think.
But I'm with you too that the having the one seeds in the
Florida
tournament.
Texas Tech was Elite Eight, but okay.
That was a great game. That was a great game. Having the Texas Tech blew that thing. Should have won.
Yeah, having the one seeds in it should, again, it should. I knocked on the mic.
I was like, what are you doing over there, man?
If we have two blowouts, I don't. What's the conversation going to be? Like, look, I mean,
I'm not guaranteeing.
Houston wins by 10 points. Are we going to say that it's boring? Because I don't.
Yeah, I'm saying it's boring now. So if we get blowouts, yes, I will continue to say that this tournament stinks. Like, Drew, if it stunk the whole way and then the last few games stink, then yeah, it stunk. Like, I'm not going to change my opinion based on what. Can it redeem itself in my eyes a little bit? If Gold's right, and four number one seeds and the four best teams in the country, which I think we all agree with, have three epic battles, cool. Kind of a saving grace. To that point, Gold, I'll care less.
Yeah,
it's a four seed didn't get there or anything like that. That's fine.
Yeah. We've talked a ton about, NIL's impact on this tournament, what's to be expected, and this is only the second time that we've seen all four number ones make it to a Final Four. Even in the NIL, I truly think this is a unique year. Yes, will there be less mid-majors going on deep runs? I think overall, correct. But I also think there's going to be an overreaction. Like next year, when everybody's filling out their brackets next March, and we're talking about bets next March for the tournament, you're going to actually maybe be able to get value on the mid-majors because everybody's just going to assume that it's going to be all the powerhouses that win again. I would not be surprised next year if we get back to seeing some of the upsets. Now, do I think we're going to see the same stretch of like three double-digit seeds making the Sweet 16 again? I don't know if we'll ever see that again. I'm not sure. But I don't think now we're just going to always have the top four seeds make it. This is a unique year because these really were the four best team, like not just because they're in the final. Truly, these were the four best teams all year. It was not a tough call for the committee to determine who the four number one seeds were when they were coming up with Selection Sunday.
So if you're excited about, like, I totally understand, like, especially for you, Gold, you made this point long before. You're fine with upsets until we get to the Final Four, and then you want, like, the big boys, right? You want the best teams going, and it doesn't mean you get a good game, Drew, to your point. It doesn't mean you get a good national championship game. UConn can still just run you out of the building. I'm not saying the entire tournament is determined based on what happens in the game. I'm just saying, like, the only way to salvage it for me is that version of it. And yeah, I do think that you lose some of the tournament magic if it turns into college football and it's just Georgia and Alabama and the same five schools every year down there into the wire. It takes some of the juice out of it a little bit for it. And yeah, to this point, I don't think there's been enough good games. Just overall, I don't think there's been enough good games.
There's been a more disparity, I think, along the lines of just the first round, whether it's upsets or not. It's interesting because I think the same thing happens in college football where we all want the Cinderella story to be there. And then when they play, like when St. Peter's got killed by Kentucky in the Elite Eight, whatever year that was, a few years ago, everybody was like, I would have rather seen somebody else other than St. Peter's in there. But those are the same people who wanted St. Peter's to get there in the first place. So you got to make up your mind. Either you want to see the blowout of a Cinderella team get smacked in the Sweet 16 or the Elite Eight, or
fine with that.
You want to see a better matchup, which is not going to have St. Peter's
Which doesn't guarantee me not a blowout, though. That's the problem. It's like, On the other one, at least I get the Cinderella. The good matchup, right? Alabama and Duke doesn't guarantee me a good game. They got their ass kicked.
No, I just think it says more and more, though, like the four that are left are that much better than everybody else. That's at least how I took it. Like these four were the dominant teams in college basketball. By the way, Florida, Auburn, Florida's a 2.5-point favorite. Duke, Houston's the late game on Saturday in San Antonio. Duke, a 4.5-point favorite right now on Houston heading in to the Final Four. I know later on in the week, I'm sure we'll talk more about this, but let's go ahead before we get to Trash of the Day. Talk about something that caught your attention regards to the 49ers, who are in a weird spot as an organization right now. They still need to pay their quarterback, Brock Purdy, as well.
And they seem like they're in like a semi-rebuild, but like Ayuk, by all accounts this week, is probably not going to get traded. Stood out to me because I think it should make you appreciate more the Chiefs' level of consistently high play all the way deep into playoff games, knowing what a starting quarterback said for another team who has not been going through anywhere near with this. Brock Purdy spoke this weekend because they got like NFL meetings. And so there's like some players around and some stuff out there and some interview stuff. But he told 49ers webzone.com, "And last year, man, guys, we were tired. That season was no joke. When you go from July and training and everything and the end of February, those guys' bodies are beat up. It's hard to keep going deep into NFC title games and maintain that level of play," is what he is admitting. The 49ers went to like a couple, not five Super Bowls in 6 years. They missed the playoffs last year and have missed the playoffs, I think, in the last 6 years as well. And he was complaining that the guys were beat because they had to go to the Super Bowl or go to another NFC title game for a couple of years in a row, and the shortening of the offseason and everything else. And it just made me appreciate even more. You almost never hear anything like that come out of the Chiefs, and they have played more football by a large margin than any other team in football by a lot.
No question. I mean, I think Brock Purdy's correct. I don't fault them for saying that, but yes.
I don't think he's lying about it. I don't know if they were kind of beat.
It's why so many people didn't think they could go back-to-back. It's why so many people didn't think
2020.
It's why so many people didn't think they could get to a third straight Super Bowl. You know, and Travis Kelce has talked about just the wear and tear on his body during this run. You know, you're right. They don't use it as an excuse, but they definitely acknowledge it, I think, right? I mean, you have to. I mean, how can you not? That you just add up the pure amount of games and how many, you know, over the course of some of these guys' careers, they're playing another full season or two by the time it's over.
And it's a three-year run for them, by the way. Conference title game, lost deep. In the Super Bowl.
The Niners played very deep in the season. That's why they had their window. It was open. They gave a good run. They ran into the Chiefs twice, and now it's a mini reset that they got going on. You know, and that's, it definitely does allow you to appreciate what the Chiefs are doing more. I think Kyle Shanahan will have the 49ers in another year or two back in the picture. I think this next year is truly a wild card. I don't know what to expect from the 49ers here in 2025. Brock Purdy's going to clearly get a deal at some point this offseason. They're saying $55 million, $60 million a year is what he's going to get paid. But, you know, the Chiefs have had a grind of the last 5 years. Fortunately, they have the success and the trophies to also go with it. They're not empty-handed like the 49ers are. Imagine working your ass off the way the Niners have, and they have got nothing to show for it.
Actually, impressive enough, 7 years. 7 years in a row, the Chiefs' shortest trip, as we've discussed before in the show. But for the point of we're tired after 3 years, it really gassed us, and we just went 6-11 and had a miserable season because all the guys were worn down a little bit. They did it 3 years in a row. The Chiefs have gone to at least the AFC title game for seven consecutive seasons, including five full-blown ass Super Bowl trips in that run. And so, like if you think that they're tired, imagine how the Chiefs feel. And they have not. The impressive thing is really the point of this is they have not let that stop them from being the level of successful that they are. The worst season from a win total during any of those seven was 11 wins. They won the Super Bowl that year. As we pointed out before, the worst season they've ever finished in is overtime in an AFC title game.
Trash of the Day.
All right, this one takes us to the Pacific Northwest. We go out to Oregon. Portland, I believe, to be exact. It's a CBS affiliate. Had a story about an issue someone's having with the recycling bin. Take a listen.
Yeah, this is the bin.
This is a story that begins with a blue recycling bin. But trust me, it doesn't end there.
It is tragically gross.
And that may be putting it lightly.
So you're kind of like, okay, this is disgusting.
Alex Van Dyne spent years working in television news throughout the country, but he never imagined standing in front of the camera talking about...
You kind of know what the urine smells like.
Yes, urine. That's what this story is about. But before you turn away, understand that this could be you, living in a Northeast Portland neighborhood, minding your own business when he shows up in the middle of the night. This all started in September when Van Dyne and his wife noticed their garbage bins had not been collected.
So I went to open the blue bin, and lo and behold, there was a nice deposit of gallon-sized bottles of urine, to put it plainly. And there were six of them.
Six
bottles of urine in his recycling bin. The garbage hauler wouldn't take it. It's biohazard.
So what does your wife think about all this?
Yeah, she's befuddled as well.
Eventually, Van Dyne pulled his garbage bins, hoping that the urine dropper would go away. And he did. Straight to the neighbor's bin, and then another neighbor.
Sort of started to, you know, unravel. And I don't know why he's hitting the same location so many times. That doesn't make any sense to me. And or why he is doing it.
Van Dyne has shared his ordeal on the social app called Nextdoor. He's been flooded with theories as to the reason behind it all.
Somebody was like, maybe it's a ring that they've kidnapped some people and they're trying to get rid of their fecal matter.
Okay.
In the most bizarre way possible.
Deep conspiracy.
All right. So the last part, that I don't think it's that there's a bunch of people kidnapped and they're getting rid of their urine from all these people.
Although, they just pour it out somewhere? If that's what they were doing, why the hell would they take it to different people's trash can in the neighborhood?
A lot of questions. One, multiple gallons. That is a lot of urine. The
how
other
much
part
water
is
that guy drinking? And by the way, based on the videos, he's not drinking enough. He's looking a little dehydrated based on the video.
I'm confused. Why not just throw it in like the dumpster behind a business or something? Why are you putting it in people's recycling bins? Is this person living out of their car? I don't know. But like, that's a lot. If it's just this one person, there's no way it's just one person's, though. That's
also
too much. There's multiple gallons.
I kind of agree to that. I guess I've never measured it over the course of an entire week. There's no way 5 full gallons of urine, right?
Let's do a quick Google search.
In a single week?
How many?
That seems kind of crazy.
Do you?
How many gallons?
Yeah, hold on.
What's it say?
An excessive amount of volume per day, 2.5, any more than 2.5 liters is excessive.
Okay. So, I'm not getting through 5 gallons a week.
No. 40 to 50 ounces of urine a day.
So this has got to be more than one person's worth of this. The fact that he caught him on video, removed his cans, and then this guy just kept going and putting it in other
Not this guy's problem anymore.
Yeah, he made it.
Although he can't recycle right now, I guess.
Well, now he should be able to. He doesn't have any more urine in his.
Well, no, he pulled the recycling bin back. That's why the guy stopped. He's not putting his recycling bin out anymore.
Like, not even, like, day of?
No, sounds like no. Well, maybe you could do that.
And would you put
at least this guy's recycling? Okay,
not really. He's putting biohazard.
They
material.
Can't recycle. That's the issue.
Yeah, they're not even allowing this guy to do it. Then what do you? By the way, what do you do? This guy said the recycling company won't take it. You got to personally handle 5 gallons of this guy's urine.
Yeah, what was he doing with it before? You're right. What do you do?
What do you do? You can't throw it away in the garbage. You
well,
have to like, get some gloves and
no,
a mask.
Probably did put it in the garbage.
Pour it out?
Probably did throw it away, even if you're not supposed to. You probably put it in the garbage. I mean, that's what you would have to do, right?
You're not pouring it
out in your front yard.
Where else? You can't put it in the garbage.
The smell would be all... No, you're not opening the gallon and
stale pee?
And pouring it into your yard. No.
I mean, I need a mask.
Maybe you'd pour it down the sewer, although I don't think you're supposed to do that either, you know?
Don't think so.
I don't think you're supposed to do that.
You're pour things down the sewer because you feel like it, no.
Someone says maybe it's Chiefsaholic's mom and brother. Yeah, if you watch the documentary, they were urinating in
bags. And throwing it in like plastic sacks.
So maybe this person's living in the car. Maybe there's a little bit of mental health thing. I don't know. But the videos.
I get a lock. I think I would switch to a lock, and then I just unlock it the night before.
Just put the gallons next to it. Do you think the guy dropping off the urine thinks it's the trash bin, not the recycling bin?
I don't know. Hard to say. I don't think it matters if it's trash or recycling. I don't think they're taking it either way.
Well, if it's in a trash bag, they're not. They wouldn't know.
In a trash bag, no. But in a bin, they'd still know. Same problem as before.
True.
They probably poured that thing in his trash bin one time, got covered in urine, and they're like, "I'm picking up this guy's recycling anymore."
The neighbors should all wait up. And when they see this guy pull up, they should all run out at the same time.
Yeah, I'll be having a stakeout at this point.
Oh, yeah, because then who knows what this guy's... I mean, you don't know. Oh, yeah, you want to have a real, real conflict. I guess if there's plenty of you, you're good.
I'd take a day off work, and I would wait for this person to show up and then try to follow and figure out where they're going.
That's the trash of the day. That is...
Wait, you would follow them?
Yes.
That's weird.
I got to find out.
You're asking for problems.
Yeah, that's probably true.
All right. Up next, we'll get to the Chiefs Run half hour, but because we've got some Royals baseball coming your way with Vern's On Deck show at noon, we're actually going to talk a little Royals baseball. We'll mix in some NFL as well. That's coming up next right here on Cody and Gold. Coming up in 25 minutes, Vern's On Deck show gets underway. It's the first road game of the year for the Kansas City Royals right here on your home for the Royals, 96.5 The Fan. The Royals are in Milwaukee this afternoon. Chris Bubich will make his first start of 2025. Jonathan India in the lineup after the scare yesterday. That's good news. Also, one other bit of information before we get to a little bit of football. We started the show today talking about the news with Sporting Kansas City. If you missed us earlier in the show, you can check the podcast. But Peter Vermes out as manager of Sporting Kansas City. Unbelievable run, but it was time. It was time. 195 days since they had won a match. They had a draw earlier this year. And then you go back to a year or so ago when fans at that point were calling for his dismissal. He ended up retaining his job. The Cauldron put out a statement after Saturday's loss. Sounds like this was in the works long before then, but doesn't help when your supporters are calling for the firing as well. But we also, if you go back and listen to the podcast, acknowledged where soccer is in Kansas City doesn't
because
exist
of them,
because
yeah.
It doesn't exist without Peter Vermes and the contributions that he made. The World Cup would not be here in 2026 if it wasn't for what he built. MLS Cup champions, of course, in 2013. One of the only individuals, I believe, in MLS history to have MLS Cup win as a player and as a and as a manager as well. So sometimes no matter how much you did for a city, for an organization, there is always there's always a time where it is best for everybody to move on, and that's where Sporting Kansas City is at.
Andy Reid, when it came to Philadelphia, now he didn't win a Super Bowl there,
no.
But like this happens in sports a lot where your time runs out because you're just too long. I don't think it's like the direct Batman line
and it's
of becoming the villain. Like, I don't think he's the villain. I think people will look fondly upon his career here, but like the last 2 years were totally unnecessary when they extended him. They should have gotten out years ago.
And it's a big shift for the whole organization because, as we know, he wasn't just coaching. He was involved in player development and everything mm-hmm. around the entire organization. So a big shift, a big decision by Sporting Kansas City, and I think tomorrow there's a press conference to talk about steps moving forward and things. There's still a ton of the season left. I mean, there's six matches in. I think it's only March 31st. This thing is they got months and months. So they'll have a long time to search for the eventual replacement. One other bit of news the Chiefs just put out just kind of reminds you about how there's all these international games that are going to continue to happen overseas. We'll find out if the Chiefs are international or not this year, but they did announce that you can add the United Kingdom, Ireland, and Spain as their countries that they are allowed to have marketing rights for. Remember, it had been like Germany and a few mm-hmm. others, but add the UK, Ireland, and Spain, part of their
Ireland,
markets
huh?
that they
Isn't
can
there
promote.
A game in
there is
Ireland this year.
Well, yeah, the Rooney family. So Steelers are playing in Ireland to open
Did
up.
The Chiefs play the Steelers this year.
They
play the North.
No, I don't believe so.
Okay,
no. The question for an international game this year is if they play that Friday night one against the Chargers. Otherwise, I think they're back in Germany very, very soon, though. I think Germany trip is they're due for another one, man. They played in Frankfurt last time, right?
Yeah, and that's been their big push. They got a good fan base there. But yeah, the international stuff, we know how this works. Speaking of football and the Steelers, I did see the headlines this weekend, too, that the Steelers would like an answer from Aaron Rodgers, even though there is no timeline, and actually said he would start Mason Rudolph week one if they wanted to. And I did see that Rodgers and DK Metcalf had a throwing session reportedly this weekend.
All right.
Why? How? How is the most successful coach at avoiding the drama in the outward perspective involving himself in this? He's so desperate for Aaron Rodgers, and we all know it. You can try to be like, there's no timetable. You don't want to start Mason Rudolph week one. You don't want to start Jackson Dart week one or some other dude. You want Aaron Rodgers. We get it.
They must, behind the scenes, have some sort of idea or assurance from Aaron Rodgers' camp or him himself that, yeah, I'll be there eventually. I'm going to sign this deal. Otherwise,
I'll be there eventually. He's got another trip planned.
Otherwise, letting Russell Wilson sign somewhere, letting Justin Fields sign somewhere, makes no sense, because otherwise they are going to be starting Mason Rudolph week one of the season. And Mike Tomlin will still find a way to start 3-1 or something like that. But
Mason Rudolph versus Carson Wentz, yeah, or Mason Rudolph versus Will Levis.
They still, if there was any player, and this is just, he has shown it to be true. I don't think this is inaccurate. If there was one player that I would not be able to trust as much to, hey, he assured us, guys, that he said he's going to eventually make a decision and we think we're pretty good. He's going to choose us. He's not going to retire. If there's one player that could go on an ayahuasca trip and then say, you know what? I kind of like this chill life of not doing a damn thing anymore.
He missed part of training camp to go on one last year, didn't he?
It would be Aaron Rodgers. Yes, for his Netflix show, which was called Enigma.
Yeah, you're saying go on his ayahuasca trip, he missed a chunk of training camp in a year in which he absolutely stunk. You think he won't just quit? He'd quit.
So you're saying we can't be surprised if he kind of hangs the Steelers out to dry in a way, is what you're saying, where it's like, hey, I'll make a decision, and all of a sudden he comes to this epiphany of, you know what? I actually like chilling on the beach, and it's June.
Look, I think he probably has told him that he's going to. If there was a player I would trust that could just change his mind like that, of course it's Aaron Rodgers. So my guess is he still ends up playing for the Steelers, but nobody should be surprised if we woke up in July and he said, you know what, actually, I'm out.
Is Mason the kind of guy who got made part into training camp and decided he doesn't like it anymore?
Is Rudolph the only guy that doesn't have or is he the only quarterback on the roster?
I think they have one other quarterback now. But okay. I actually, for those who are like, oh, there's no way they would possibly start Rudolph. He's done it before. I actually think they would. Now, I think in that scenario, if it was before the draft and Rodgers said, I'm retiring before the draft, I think they would draft a Jackson Dart, a Quinn Ewers, somebody like that. And then Rudolph would start week one, see how it goes. And then you would see Jackson Dart or somebody come in.
You might be able to get Ewers in like the second or third, where you might just take the pick anyways.
And then you got to promise yourself you're starting him by week eight, though, because you got to find out on him before the next offseason, and you got to figure something out, you know, like,
right.
I actually don't think it's one of those, like, let's sit and develop him. I think that's the kind of quarterback you have to play immediately.
Especially with viewers, because he's been around the block a little bit.
I was trying to think this weekend on Infinity Sports Network. Grant and I were doing our show we do on Saturdays, and we were having this very discussion. We were trying
Skylar
to think.
Skylar Thompson, by the way.
Okay, Skylar's the other. Okay, yeah, I knew there was two. Yeah, okay, yeah. Skylar Thompson. We were having a discussion on Saturday about, all right, let's say he retired tomorrow, Rodgers, that is, and they really didn't want to go with Mason Rudolph. What is there a veteran quarterback we're not thinking of that's on a team you could trade for? Like, well, Kirk Cousins, of course, is the obvious, but we were looking at the financials. It doesn't, you could maneuver the cap around, but it seems like the Falcons are content, because otherwise, trading for Kirk Cousins, there's nobody else. They're free agency. There's still Carson Wentz. There's Drew Locke. There's guys like that that you could look to. But in terms of trading, I'm not sure.
Yeah,
but in terms of trading for a veteran, Kirk Cousins would be the only one left. There's nobody else, right? We were trying to come up with names. We
trade for?
Correct. No. That's it. I mean,
yeah. No, there's not enough. I was trying to think.
The only other team we came up with, and it's not a true veteran situation, would be if the Colts were convinced Daniel Jones was their starter and they said, we're just done with Anthony Richardson, although I think he kind of stinks. But maybe, like, you would say, all right,
I think he ruined his career the second he tapped out of that play.
Would be the only thing I could say. Would the Steelers call the Colts and say, hey, Anthony, if the Steelers even like Anthony Richardson. But these are
so bad. It's like, this is where they're at.
Will,
you know,
Levis
situation
is the only other answer for the same as Anthony.
He's going to be starting for the Titans unless they draft Cam Ward.
I think they take Cam Ward and then Will Levis.
So do I. But
again, is Will Levis a veteran quarterback or just a quarterback who exists?
He exists
started
right
like
now.
15 games. I'm not even sure if he qualifies
like
under
Zach
the conditions. Yeah, I'm not even sure he qualifies under the conditions you're offering me, which is like a guy who used to start in the NFL for a number of seasons.
If you're also trying to win, I think you would take Mason Rudolph over Will Levis.
I would say. I would at this point. It's still,
I don't know if the
because
Steelers
he's won
it
in Pittsburgh before with Tomlin.
I do wonder if
when I say won, by the way, well, he's won games, actual games, not as he hasn't won a bunch. He's won literally has won a game or two or three.
I know they don't think on this radar, but Drew Aller, Penn State, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, maybe they wait out a year and they just say, you know what, we're just going to ride it out another season and try to get Drew Aller.
Maybe I'm wrong, but.
Oh, well, that's a different conversation. Like, looking 2026 draft,
I don't
know.
But I don't think Tomlin has it in his DNA to give up a year
to go 4-13.
He'd win eight games or nine. He'd win 8 or 9 games with Mason Rudolph. Still, he would by some miracle. Like Drew, as much as we give you a hard time, they would be 3-1 in September. Your Bengals would be 1-3, he'd have Mason Rudolph. And be like, what the hell's going on?
With a win against Cincinnati somehow in September.
Don't even get me started because that's exactly how it would go.
So what about Ryan Tannehill? He sat out all of last year, isn't he? I don't know if he's officially retired, but he sat out a whole year.
I'd rather play him than Mason Rudolph, though.
What's he doing though? He hasn't played in a whole year.
Was he actually on the couch?
Yeah, he was on the couch.
He was cut from the Titans, correct? I think after.
Yeah, but he was too expensive. Like there was some offset.
Right,
and there was
some rumors around him getting.
He's 36 now.
Is he really?
He's Ryan Tannehill's 36. He hasn't played since 2023, guys. I mean, it's just
Mason Rudolph. He feels like gonna be 40 at this point.
No.
He's been in the league for
Ryan Tannehill's 36.
Ryan Tannehill is.
That's crazy.
Mason Rudolph is 29 years old.
Feels so much older than that, doesn't
he? There is no way he's that old. It's crazy. I can't even.
Mason Rudolph was 5-3 in 2019 with the Steelers as their quarterback. Overall, he is 9-8-1 because he was just 1-4 with Tennessee last year. He's 9-8-1 as a starter. But prior to going to Tennessee, guys, you know?
Almost, you know. Tannehill had a run of being a top 15 quarterback.
I would hate to be a Steelers fan. I mean, what a brutal spot.
Yep.
You're waiting on
you
Aaron.
Loved it for a while when they went in Super Bowls.
You're waiting on Aaron Rodgers for starters. And even if he does come, you're a playoff team. I don't think you're a contender. And if he doesn't, Mason Rudolph, it's going to be miserable to watch. Maybe you win 9 games somehow by a miracle. Tomlin gets you as the last wild card team that's going to get their ass kicked in the first wild card game again.
You don't get a top pick.
Nope.
It is kind of Ryan Tannehill. This is so off topic before we get to the Royals game, but. Ryan Tannehill's career should be borderline marveled at. He was a top 15 quarterback for like a 2-3-4 year run, and he was playing wide receiver at A&M before he was drafted.
Yeah.
He wasn't even playing quarterback. He was a wide receiver.
How much do you think? Here, we
makes
can play,
no sense.
We can play the fun game. How much do you think Ryan Tannehill has made in his NFL career? I'm pulling it up right now.
$98 million is my official guess. Oh man, that might be low.
Yeah, I'm going to say 115.
I said 98. I should have thought about a higher.
Both
number,
too low.
Damn.
Wow.
11 years in the league.
11 years.
$195 million. Actually, almost 196. 195 and 975,000.
My ass ain't getting off the couch for the Steelers.
Oh, yeah, why would he need to go play again? He made $123 million for the Titans for 5 years and $72 million for 8 years with the Dolphins. Remember when that was a as you said a big trade at the time when the Titans traded for him from Miami.
Yeah, it was. And it worked for the Titans for a few years.
They were the one seed, yeah.
The final 3 minutes of the show, the Awaken 180, 180 seconds brought to you by Awaken 180. Results every week. Receive free support for life online at awaken180weightloss.com. I was just thinking about that career.
It's a
weird career. Wide receiver, drafted as a quarterback in Miami, flunk out to a different thing, but like successful. Like an 11-year career as an NFL quarterback.
Royals and Brewers going to start a little after 1 o'clock today from Milwaukee. Vern's on deck show about 12-13 minutes away. We'll hand it off to him. We talked about just the opening weekend and, you know, there's overreactions and things like that. Things you would love to see today, though. 5-9 after 10 strikeouts across the entire weekend. What's 5-9 do against Milwaukee, who got beat up by the Yankees and the torpedo bats?
Rocked. I'd like to see MJ Melendez with the torpedo bat today at 1 o'clock.
Well,
slugging dingers.
That would be fun. I think not that Bobby's been bad, but like I think for people like, oh, you know, why isn't he off to a really flaming hot start? Bobby Witt Jr. today, 2 or more total bases is one of my favorite bets of the day, and I do think the Royals get a win.
I took a shot on a parlay that I don't think will hit, but
okay,
a little 10-1-er.
Oh, all right.
10-1-er, you ready?
Let's hear it.
Royals money line. Okay. I like the starting pitching matchup for the Royals.
Bubich.
I'm big on Bubich this year, so I'm going to take a chance. And I feel like they got to be down on themselves. So I got the Royals just to win. Jonathan India to get one or more hit, and Bobby hit a homer.
All right.
So a little 10-1-er. That's what I got in action today. So we'll see what goes. So Bobby hit a homer, India to get a hit, and the Royals just to win. I feel like if I get the other two things, the Royals win part of that actually is a little bit easier.
Probably.
You know?
As long as Bubich is, you know, is there a chance he has the sharpest outing of any of the starters?
I haven't had a good day.
You know, yet. I mean, you take a look at Thursday and Saturday, neither starter Lugo or Reagans were sharp. They still kind of gutted through and got you to where they weren't an early, early exit in the game. But yeah, it'd be nice to... Be nice to have a really solid quality outing from a starting pitcher in game four of the season since they haven't had that yet.
Just a little reassurance because you don't really know what you got in the 4 or 5 spot. As Vern, I think, pointed out to us, Singer, you could have made the argument, and at times last year with Marsh, with both those guys, you could have made the argument that they were pitching like the third best guy in the staff. Well, you need 4 and 5 to look like that for stretches this year. Bubich is our first look at the 4-5, him and Lorenzen. And I think eventually Lorenzen ends up out of the rotation, and it does end up being a guy like Marsh, or it ends up being a guy like Kyle Wright, mm-hmm. whoever. But like today, yeah, I would like to see like I'm a big believer in Chris Bubich this year. I'd like to have it start well so you can actually believe it.
Someone says Royals 5 or more homers today. Mark my words. I will mark that text down from the 307.
So okay. It has nothing to do with the torpedo bats. It just turns out the Milwaukee Brewers can't help but give up home runs every single day.
There's a possibility. That's what it is. Yes.
That was the other reason I bet Bobby to hit a homer. I'm like, you know what? I don't see anybody in that staff getting anybody out right now. Might as well take a chance.
That's very true. Hopefully they can continue that and get their record to 2-3 after today's action. Game one of a series against the Milwaukee Brewers starts a little after 1:00. That's going to do it for us today. Short show. We're back into baseball season. This will happen every once in a while. Appreciate you guys hanging out with us. Tomorrow we'll talk a little more draft. We'll obviously talk about how the Royals fared against the Milwaukee Brewers. But it is time to hand things off to Josh Vernier. His On Deck show coming your way right here on 96.5 The Fan.